So, I mean, one thing I wanted to get to, and it was back when I lost my point, I think, was the fragmentation of the psyche.
Yeah.
Which, because you've just read Carl Scher, and probably even if you hadn't, but I'm guessing it's an interpretation that you're comfortable with.
Yes.
You can relate to, and that you can understand your own experience through that lens.
Yes.
Which is true for myself too. It's something I've used a lot in the last few years, and it's always difficult to talk about, and because it's difficult to even think about, and to talk about something you can't think about is, yeah, that's actually liminalism is what I aspire to, but because there's a way to understand things by talking about them, it's possible the body can express something I'm not able, the mind can't.
No? Yes.
And yet it's still using language.
Yes.
That was a side point. The fragmentation of the psyche, maybe even because I'm not really able to talk about it coherently, is something I'm experiencing more. My own fragmentation. Which I think is congruent with the healing.
Yes.
Whatever the opposite of fragmentation is, it's like putting Humpty back together again.
Yes.
It is possible with not the king's horses or the king's men, but something else. The psyche itself is looking to become whole.
Yes.
And yet it was the psyche itself that fragmented itself.
In order to protect itself.
In order to protect itself from something that was unbearable to the organism.
Yes.
Not so much to the psyche, it seems. It seems as though it was a physical...
This points to my observation is that even though we talk as if the psyche is separate from the body, the psyche fragmented itself to protect the physical organism.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't see any separation there.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I've been starting to experience is going back to, I think, what we were talking about before. It's quite hard to keep a mental track of this conversation around the ego and how the ego can't get rid of itself. And it was when we were talking about how the thing that we think we're trying to experience is already... The part of us that's trying to experience the thing that it's not experiencing doesn't need to experience it because it's the whole of us is already experiencing
it.
It's already there. So with the psyche, like the fragmentation, the way that the fragmentation happened was compartmentalizing awareness to protect the organism from the onslaught of insurmountable trauma or trauma that was too much to process by the organism during the time that it happened. So there's a fragmentation which caused a compartmentalization of awareness so that part of our whole awareness got trapped separate from the totality.
Yes.
So it's as if I've been living my life and you lived much of your life without joy inside a fragment or as a fragment. And yet the whole psyche, I mean, the very thing that makes it the psyche and makes us feel that longing to reconnect to it is that's us. So that the majority of the psyche that we feel cut off from is living a life anyway.
Yes.
Despite the fact that we're not getting it.
Correct.
Right?
Absolutely correct.
Logically, it's correct, but also somehow experientially. Like you say, for me, I was saying earlier about the dream, when I wake up in the morning, it's like I can hear the water running under the rock and I'm dying of thirst. That metaphor, it's the same. I know that I'm living this life, but I can't access it.
Yes.
Through dreams, at least, but also in other ways. Through the lack of joy, for example.
Yes. The interesting thing about that is, you're right on point, is that even though the psyche has fragmented itself and compartmentalized things, and it does that even in physical manifestations too, stiffness in the body, poor health.
That was the only thing that corresponds to what you're saying about the body compartmentalizing, putting anger into different parts, yeah, and so on. Yeah,
and it does it with the multiple personality expressions too.
Yeah. Right?
So at work you're a certain person, at home you're a certain person, and your charity work you're a certain person.
Yeah, social alters.
Yeah, all your social alters. That's it, the alters. Thank you. Yeah. At the same time, and this is kind of odd, is that if you have an opportunity to get quiet, is that somewhere there is an awareness that they're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that we move towards that, if in fact we're willing to change.
Mm-hmm.
So even while the compartmentalization has occurred, at the same time, there is an awareness or a longing, we'll call it awareness, longing towards a unification. So something wants us to move along.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of magical. How does that happen?
Mm-hmm. So that's what you were referring to earlier about the different levels of yourself, but also the universe prompting us, and goading us, and challenging us,
yes,
confronting us,
yep,
in this way that is indifferent to our own happiness.
Yes. Absolutely.
Because it wants wholeness.
It wants wholeness. And from wholeness is joy, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So my joy that I've experienced now isn't, I want to say universal, that's not the right, is not contiguous.
It's not right? Continuous?
Continuous. Because I still haven't fully defragmented myself, or I haven't allowed myself to be fully defragmented.
That's what you do on a hard drive, isn't
correct
it? Defragging. So yeah, I hadn't thought of that term, to be defragmented.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so, but I know that the process is alive and well, and past a certain tipping point or turning point, right, it seems very, very hard. So a long time ago, you'd spend months in waking up wanting to be dead, or whatever your own personal demon was, but that changes at some point along the way, and you recognize that that's transitory, that it's not permanent. For a long time, you always think it's going to be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young, especially, that whatever you're feeling there will never go away.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't. It goes away as long as you're open to the possibility of change.
Mm-hmm.
And we each find that possibility in different ways. So, at some point along the way, the alcoholic who hits bottom, that bottom for that alcoholic is something needs to change. Okay, I will change.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But a lot of alcoholics don't embrace change.
And it's, again, it's that very almost infinitesimally fine balance between resisting change and trying to make change happen, because that doesn't work either.
Correct.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make change happen, that's the ego talking, and the ego's too small. One of the interesting things that I always find remarkable about the AA program is one of their key steps is universe is big, I am small.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But as long as the ego thinks that it can force its will, sort of misuse of language there, force its will upon the universe, it will always be losing the fight.
Why is it a misuse of language?
Because does the ego have will?
Yeah. Well, the will to power is ego, yes. I think. And so I, at this stage, rightly or wrongly, I associate will with ego.
Okay.
In the sense of, but that's self-will, which is impotent.
Yes.
So, but then does the universe have will? Does God have will? It seems almost as though then that becomes redundant, because the universe, the motion of the universe itself is what we could call will if we wanted to.
Yes.
There isn't something willing it.
No.
So.
And I have quietly slid back to just awareness.
Yeah.
That seems comfortable for me at this point of my existence.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't have the wishing to die thing much these days, but I do have, and recently spoke about it in the last podcast, so I don't want to repeat it too much, but just the difficulty getting out of bed in the morning, some yes. mornings. And it's pertinent now because to what we're talking about, I think, because a large part of it, I'm realizing, is, well, it's largely physical. The mental and emotional aspect of it comes after the physical, the somatic. And yes. so it's a physical experience of being weak, of being afflicted, of being oppressed, of being of lacking energy, and I'm trying to keep words to very, you know, not exactly neutral, but not too much interpretation or guesswork, but also I would say like poisons running through my system. And that, okay, so there's various things about this. As far as awareness, that seems to be what is happening. Like, me getting to be aware of the poisons, that's it. I don't have to get up, I just have to be aware of the poisons. And then as far as what the poisons are, or how they relate to what we're talking about, I'd say this is the fragmentation of the psyche, and the compartmentalization of different emotions. I won't say negative, but emotions getting trapped in the body relates to the poisons.
Yes.
That those three things are all interconnected. For me, yes. it started in the womb because my mother was alcoholic, drinking while I was in the womb, which is a way to suppress rage and sorrow and overwhelming emotions. So I would say not just the alcohol was poisoning me, but also the emotions that my mother wasn't allowing herself to feel.
Probably more the emotions and my feeling of things.
Mm.
Right. Probably more the emotions. My mother was also, I don't think she was an alcoholic at the time, but she drank a lot and she smoked a lot.
Right.
So the same issues there in a sense.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we're literally wounded.
Yes.
By the world, yes. by the mother, and the absent father,
yes.
possibly the father too, if he was abusive in some way, but whatever. I mean,
and there's different forms of abuse.
Different forms and different levels, and it builds up.
And there's absences and abuse, mm-hmm. differences in abuse.
Mm-hmm. So, and the cause of our fragmentation and our contamination or our disconnection, whatever words we're going to put on it, what we've just been talking about, the causes are relevant. How would you say?
The causes are irrelevant.
You would say they are not relevant.
They're not relevant.
So then what about understanding one's past or having a sense of how one was shaped by the past?
The causes are irrelevant, but awareness of the cause in the present is not irrelevant. In other words, it's probably not absolutely required, and this is just theoretical in my mind right now, it's probably absolutely not required to know that your mother was an alcoholic, right? To, in fact, become aware of the fact that your system is poisoned.
Right.
And that you need to change.
Okay, so now we're back to the change thing, and actually that was the other thing I wanted to zero on in the morning. I think it's a good metaphor for this need to change thing. When you were talking about the change and the need to change, I had an image which was something pushing forward. And that pushing forward thing was the need to change, and that pushing forward prevented the change from coming in. So, like, change is constant. Change happens. whatever
yes,
we
it
do.
does.
The only thing, I mean, we can avoid change and we can resist it, but then we just get a more apocalyptic change
and
in
it
the
still,
long run.
We still,
it breaks through.
Yeah,
so you can't actually avoid change.
No, not really.
But you can think you are.
Yes.
You can,
the ego can pretend that it can actually hold control of the universe.
Right. So then the need to change, or recognizing the need to change, entails or would allow for an accepting of how one is
yes.
right now. That would be the way to allow change to happen, would
yes.
be to fully accept how we are now.
Yes.
So when I'm lying in bed in the morning, I'm thinking, I don't want to get up. Another part of me is saying, but you have to get up because there are things to do. Just using a very basic example, I don't literally have that dialogue, but there is a thing of, well, I can't just lie here. But I can just lie there.
Yes. Yep.
So,
go ahead.
Well, so what, I mean, what is change thing? So for me, the change there is in experiencing more deeply my lack of a desire to get up.
Yes.
That's change. Yeah.
Okay, but then where the change part is then from the next step is to, well, in part, change your language.
Yeah.
And you've already started the process of changing your language because you recognize that you don't have to get up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right? One party was saying you have to get up. And the other part, no. I'm a thinking human being. I know that I don't have to get up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can lay in bed until I shit the sheets and,
mm-hmm.
and I die here if I want.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I certainly don't have to get out of bed. So part of the change is just to say, well, I don't want to get out of bed today, but I'd rather go to the toilet than shit the bed. So I'm going to get out of bed.
If it gets to that stage. I mean, that's...
But that literally is what it means. So people who get upset by doing dishes, for example.
Yeah.
Right? I said, well, you can eat on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to clean the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing with life. I fortunately was lucky in that when I was faced the days of not getting up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
is that I committed myself unknowingly to a 34 and a half year career at a job, it wasn't a career. And so I had an option of getting up, going out and making money, or not getting up and going out and making money. And because of the pragmatic nature of our universe, the reality of me making money was that I would get up and I would make money. And so the fact that I didn't want to get up in the morning was fairly irrelevant to the pragmatics of being alive.
Yeah, well, it would be for me also.
Yes.
At and this stage, I mean. Right?
So the challenge is simply to partly change your language and partly just to say, okay, it doesn't matter. Get up anyway.
Or not get up. So, I mean, talking about the pragmatic nature of the universe, but we're also talking about how everything is working towards wholeness.
Yes.
And there's nothing to say that lying in bed and shitting the sheets until you die won't take us towards wholeness.
No, except that there's something funny, and this is where awareness comes in, is that if, in fact, that was going to create wholeness in you,
mm-hmm.
you'd probably have peace in that.
Mm-hmm.
But the odds are pretty good for most of us that that will not create wholeness. It may complete something. Right?
Well, okay, so I'm using an extreme example.
I know you are,
but
it's a good example. I like it.
Maybe, but... when you talk about the odds are that won't, it's kind of easy to agree, yeah, well, there's something going wrong there, you know? But I threw away my fortune and went to become a beggar in Morocco and could have got killed and almost did get killed. Now that was more than embracing change, that was forcing change on myself.
Yes.
And it was also the opposite of pragmatic. But I would say it was pragmatic.
When I say pragmatic, it's a double-edged sword pragmatic. I mean, there's a physical pragmatic, right? There's requirements of the physical existence.
Mm.
Eat food, drink, etc. But there's also the pragmatics of the, if you want to call it the psyche or the soul or the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And the two aren't necessarily well aligned from a purely physically pragmatic perspective.
Right. Which is why I brought the example of shitting the bed, even though I don't think it's a very good one. But in terms of just being passive, even to the point of impoverishment, I think that that can be, although that is necessary for many of us to relinquish the coping mechanisms.
Elaborate on that for me.
Well, I think maybe it's back to what I was saying about self-examination having an element of evaluation. So when we examine ourselves, we're always going to have a tendency to want to look at the good stuff and not look at the bad stuff. And if we do look at the bad stuff, then we want to commend ourselves for looking at the bad stuff. We want to transform it.
Yes, I see.
Through will, not just... So that's a coping mechanism in miniature that sabotages the self-examination process all the time.
Right? Yes.
These snares. Talking with my wife the other day about how... about all these snares and how constant vigilance is required because of the things we will do to feel more safe, including trying to control others. and but we will tell ourselves we're doing it for their good.
Yes.
That's how gurus become dictators, and just how the world becomes what it is. So all of those, if you say all of those are coping mechanisms, as in ways to feel safe by controlling ourselves and our behavior, that's, I think, what I mean, that to question all of our assumptions about what is authentic, what is an authentic expression of the soul, what the psyche wants, or what will bring us closer to wholeness. Now, of course, the other side, I mean, where this can lead is a slippery slope, and why I was questioning about the trickster, is that you can start to rationalize all kinds of crazy wisdom and devious behaviors.
Yes.
So, but we don't have a moral compass.
Well,
really, I mean, well, if we're going to step off the map,
we don't have a moral compass, but I think morals, the way we think of morals, are an arbitrary...
That's what I mean by we don't have a moral compass. Yeah, I should arbitrary. Say we don't have a moral criteria. We might have an inner
guidance. There's a guidance mechanism there.
Yeah.
I had a thought there and just went out of my head.
Yeah, I hate that.
One of the things about the challenge of becoming... the difference between self-delusion and self-awareness, right? The slippery slope you described it as, right?
Yeah.
At what point along the way are we tricking ourselves into thinking that we're wise when we're not, or becoming aware when we're not, is, well, in the Jungian language, Jung would say the dreams will tell us.
Mm-hmm.
If you're lying to yourself, the dreams will tell you you're lying to you.
If you listen. Yeah.
But even if you don't listen, what can happen if, in fact, you've already made a statement to become aware of your fragmentation and aware of your place in life, if you've made that commitment to yourself, an honest commitment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then if you begin to get scared and start running away from it, right? I made this commitment and I want to become aware, but I don't really want to see. If the commitment is honest, what will happen is, whether through dreams or through the workings of the world, it will let you know when you're lying to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The dreams will tell you, as for one thing. But the universe will also start telling you that, too.
Sure, yeah. Other people, if you're discerning enough to surround yourself by.
And even if you're not discerning enough, what will happen is it may become an after-the-fact awareness,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, you may be walking down the street and someone, you know, says something or does something, or you talk to somebody, or somebody physically assaults you in some manner. It may become an awareness after the fact that was, in fact, I was being unaware of myself.
Mm-hmm.
The universe really will, if in fact you're open to change, will help you in that change. For me, one of the things that I've become aware of over time is that the things that I hold or held true, I don't think there's a single one I've really held true that hasn't changed in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes 180 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The ability to allow the truths of the past to let go is what the universe is asking us to do and helping us to do. And this is, I think, a sign of where we're being honest in our change. If in fact our truths never change,
mm-hmm.
then we're not changing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you become aware that, in fact, my truths have changed, then you really are changing in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
And the universe will tell you when you're being deluded. The I Ching, for me, one of the quotations or affirmations that I kept around myself that popped up in the I Ching quite often when I was doing the I Ching or still do the I Ching, goes something as follows, and I forget which number it's from, I can look it up. It goes, it is only when we have the courage to face ourselves exactly as we are, without any self-deception or illusion, that the light will develop out of events by which the path to success may be recognized. And I keep that around me a great deal, but I always emphasize the fact that it's without self-deception or illusion.
Mm.
The courage to face ourselves.
So this seems probably seem like a very weird sidetrack, but you grew up, you were a big fan of Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
Because my wife told me. And you know, Philip K. Dick ended up thinking the I Ching was evil.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've never done any biography reading beyond
Yeah,
his fiction.
because you know he wrote a book with that. He used it to write a
Man in
book,
the
so
High
he,
Castle.
yeah, so he was
I
really
read the book.
committed to it for a time.
Yeah.
And then after a time, he didn't use the word evil very often, so he may not have used it for that. But anyway, that was the gist of it. So, okay, I bring this up just as an interesting piece of trivia, but also hopefully I'll be able to remember because there's two things I wanted to look at. One is the general thing, which could be a sidetrack, but that when you talk about trusting the universe will guide us. Well, there is a qualifier there, which is if we're really deluded, or just if we are deluded, it's also possible we will delude ourselves about that. You know, the messages that the universe is transmitting, and
Yes.
even beyond that, if the universe and the psyche are synonymous in some way, and we have a very deep level of delusion, we can generate the very signs that we use to delude ourselves. I
Yes.
firmly believe this. I think Christians, or doesn't have to be Christians, believe that angels are guiding them, and actually it's, well, actually it would be a Christian belief rather to say that you think that they're angels but they're actually devils. But I think there's
Yes.
quite a good metaphor in that.
There is, yes.
So I'll and I just wanted to add a more specific or more personal kind of layer to that, which is that, if I can remember it, that I'm curious if you have something similar, that as I become more aware, if I'm not entirely deluded, and more aware of myself as awareness, I also become aware of distrusting myself less.
Yes.
As in, I become aware of a polar, a duality, that there is myself as awareness, and then there's another faculty. I don't want to say presence, but I was going to say presence, that is actually sabotaging at every opportunity. We
Yes.
can go back to the constructed identity because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah,
The guardian, you know.
or broken off archetypal energies from Kalshid's.
Yeah, the guardian,
Yeah.
yeah. And that can take the form of the super ego. What Freud called the super ego can be
Yes.
very spiritual and very lofty and,
Absolutely.
yeah.
It can be very delusional. Kalshid was blunt about that too. He says that guardian energy, if you want to call it that, or the constructed self, will take oneself even to death. Right? So we could go and say, like Jimmy Jones.
Who's that?
He was the
Oh,
guide.
Jim Jones,
Yeah,
yeah,
Jim Jones.
Jonestown,
Yeah, Jonestown. Right? Was he guided by God or was he guided by delusion? Was he self-aware or not self-aware?
yeah.
And in a sense, you can say, okay, it's possible to infer that the results of his endeavors are proof or evidence or suggestive of that he wasn't self-aware. If, in
Yeah.
fact, we have an idealistic notion that the purpose of awareness is peace, tranquility, love, promotion of life, and various other things. Right? So even then, we've actually got a sense that awareness has a moral compass, which is the movement towards peace, for example, or
Or wholeness,
harmony,
or even wholeness,
or
yeah.
wholeness, or
Or
harmony.
truth,
Truth.
or reality, even
Yes.
better.
Yes.
So, I mean, Jim Jones, don't want to get sidetracked again, but CIA backing, all these affiliations, whole thing, hidden intelligence operation,
Yes.
most likely. So even more tricky and knotty than delusional. But anyway, it's kind of a
But
sidetrack.
the people following them.
Yes. So those people are accountable and examinable as delusional
Yes.
or not. As in, we would have to probably agree that they were delusional because they followed,
Yes.
an untrustworthy
And the
lead.
reason I
Yeah.
kind of led in this is a bit tricky here,
Yeah.
is that I've was intrigued by Philip D. your observation of Philip K. Dick's we'll call it renunciation of the I Ching.
Yeah.
Well, there's a great book by Sheldon Kopp called If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him.
Right.
And I'm wondering if it's actually linked in a way. I'm curious enough to actually almost pursue this.
Yeah.
And the reason behind that is that if in our path we come to somebody who is a guru in the true sense, that they're able to sweep us off our feet, i.e. Jim Jones, right? Then our own personal path will become subservient to somebody else's purpose.
So when you said a guru in a true sense, you meant in the meaning of the word rather than as in a true, trustworthy guru.
Correct.
Right. As in a, it's just leader, isn't it?
As a leader. As someone who is actually able to remove from ourself our own path. Mm. And that we will stop following our path to follow somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think the difference between self-awareness and delusion is that self-awareness means that we will be following our own path.
Mm-hmm.
The tricky bit is to really, really examine whether or not you are following your own path. And that's the self-awareness thing again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's these fine little
mm-hmm.
hairy differences. But there is a feeling difference to it, right? The challenge, I think, for a lot of us is that in our culture of I'll call it indoctrination away from the truth of who we are,
mm-hmm.
is that we don't recognize when our truth is talking to us.
Mm-hmm. So my take on this is, I mean, just based on what you said, my response, obviously, is that it gets smaller. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, the message.
Yes.
The message is getting smaller and subtler and quieter, whereas, and more internalized, deeper within, whereas the guru or the cosmic signs or the messages from the universe, that tends to be a big, something that is getting more bigger and bigger and
yes.
more and more validating, and the feeling of, oh yes, it's all happening. The universe is supporting me. It's validating me. And then you have something like the law of attraction, the secret, where the whole purpose of self-awareness and harmonization with the universe, whatever it is, to get what you want, so the pursuit of happiness and the spiritual path become conflated.
Yes.
As if miraculously they are the same. Yes, you can have your cake.
And eat it too.
Forever and ever.
And
amen.
You turn into Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah.
Who's now very mournfully advertising herself as a failure as a human being so that you've joined her Weight Watchers program.
Oh, is she? I thought you were going to say as enlightened, because that could have happened too. Jim Carrey came out as enlightened a few years ago.
Did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Right. So you've described it perfectly. And Oprah Winfrey to me is the model of that, because of course she espouses all these deservedness and laws of attraction and various other things, and yet her physical being and something about herself is not content.
Mm.
When you see that advertisement on TV, there is no joy there.
Right.
And that's the difference. She's not aware of the difference, I don't think, although I've been tempted to write her a letter, oddly enough, and suggest that in fact she's lost track. But
so that's odd that you felt such a strong pull
to do that. Yes. Well, I've actually been tempted to write her a letter about 3 times in her career, because my wife used to have her on TV, and she's been on TV for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to catch Oprah Winfrey on TV, and so I've more or less seen her evolution as it's expanded from a talk show host doing the typical talk show host things to someone who becomes aware that some of the things that she was having on her show, and I'm paraphrasing her now when I say this, is that she started taking the advice of some of the people she was interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And so she changed her life and became the Oprah for we, that we know.
I don't know her, but I know when she was fat for a while and then she got thin, and that's about all I know.
No, so at one time, there was a period of time in which she was open to the possibility of change.
Mm.
And you could see that in her shows and how she was changing and various other things. And what's happened in my own perception of it, and this is my own limited perception, because of course I don't know her, but having watched, is that all of a sudden she became aware that she had the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And she now espouses it through books like The Secret, that the truth is the laws of attraction or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't recognize that if you've hung on to a truth,
it's gone.
It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, when you see her advertising Weight Watchers on TV, listen to how she talks and pay attention to how she is. There's no joy there.
Well, I mean, that is not remarkable in itself, because she's a celebrity, so
no,
that
but
lifestyle must be hideously joyless.
But again, this is now a judgment. It doesn't have to be, because joy doesn't really care about whether or not you're poor or whether or not you're rich.
No, but it cares about, I don't know about joy caring, but the psyche and, I mean, we do need an environment to grow in, I think. Like, the psyche and the universe and the body and the environment is one continuum. So
yes.
When I said that about celebrity, I mean, it's like if she was in a drug cartel.
Yes.
If she was part of the mafia. I mean, I think their environment to a wholeness just doesn't happen.
I'm not going to say that it's an easy environment in which to be whole.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's precluded. I think.
One shouldn't rule any possibilities out.
However,
in this universe.
If she's behaving things like, you know, buying $500 million yachts.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
There's definitely out of balance there, right? But like I say, I've watched her grow from a sort of this scared individual on TV who's doing interviews to someone who became somewhat aware.
So, I mean, to bring it back to... No, it's okay. I mean, to continue on this, but to refer it back to... the reward and punishment is meritocracy is a term I keep wanting to use, because it's the big lie of our world is that it is a meritocracy, and yet even if it were, as we're discussing here, that wouldn't be desirable anyway. But anyway, the idea, the world is this reward and punishment based system that is a mirror and a magnification of the inner guardian. And, you know, the self-rewarding, self-punishing defense system of the constructed identity. This is the world that you're describing Oprah Winfrey is moving in.
Yes.
So in that sense, I would say that success does correspond with lack of wholeness and does exacerbate fragmentation.
It's
feeding that mechanism.
It does, yeah. It naturally does, and I think it's just not, I don't think it's necessary, absolutely 100% required. But it is prone to that. Simply because she's fallen into, well, for her, she's fallen into a very strong notion of, if I, in fact, make manifest the laws of manifestation properly, then I'm obviously attuned properly, and then I'm doing fine.
There you go. So that's spiritual reward and punishment.
Yeah, that's spiritual masturbation is what it is.
Mm.
And it just leads to sad people advertising for weight loss on TV, I guess.
And, I mean, delusion taken to the point of insanity.
Yes,
I would say, not speaking about Oprah now,
but
and destructive insanity, because you have enormous power.
Yes, but here's where the opportunity for Oprah is that instead of advertising Weight Watchers, is to really examine herself and see why it is she's struggling with weight, and why that's so important to her.
Hence your desire to write letters to her, which you have suppressed.
I have suppressed.
So she represents an aspect of yourself out there in the universe that you resonate with.
Yeah,
she is an aspect.
Yeah, because I saw her changing, and I saw her fall into the trap of a deserved society in which she's now one of the deserving.
Mm.
And that's a sad state of affairs.
And the time, I'm guessing the timing as well is probably significant. Of what you were going through at that time. Was,
It's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Tesla left on a Thursday. At least he left the living. We found him sprawled out on the hotel floor. Stochastic ride.
Anyway, so the I Ching, back to Philip K. Dick a little bit. Because okay. I'm just speculating now.
Yeah.
As I'm wondering if part of his renunciation of that is that...
The Buddha, yeah.
Is that he needed to find his own guru, and he couldn't rely on somebody else.
You mean he needed to find his soul? Which was the last years of his life with exegesis. He was writing just for himself, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he ever did.
Yes.
But he certainly struggled more than most, and that has enormous meaning, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, life is interesting. But I don't know. I suspect that you're on the right path when you can start seeing the humor of both what it is you're doing and what it is life is doing to you.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to find joy, maybe.
Seeing the humor or actually being able to laugh?
Both.
Because I think I've been able to see the humor for a long, long time. Whereas laughter... I had a dream some time ago that I think it was my niece was telling me that I was laughing from my belly now. And I realized it was a dream when I remembered it because she hadn't said that. But I think it might be true that I may not be laughing more necessarily, but I'm laughing from a deeper place when I do laugh.
It's funny you'd say that, because the person I shared my experience with joy with made the observation, because he'd seen me change, that he said the same thing about me.
Mm.
Is that the way I laughed and how I laughed and smiled had changed a great deal.
Mm. So I think that's possibly a microcosm for what I was saying about things getting smaller, because our idea about embracing the humor, if that's spiritual progress, blah, 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 I'd be laughing all the time, like those crazy gurus in, you know, the archetypal guru is always laughing, Don Juan in Castaneda books. But actually, if it's not like that, it's a much subtler thing. And I think part of that, and this is maybe back to the trickster, is that we need to be tricked, or we need to have the experience of being tricked, because the ego, we have to get past the ego. And so the ego can observe the signs of our own movement towards wholeness. The ego is going to start, well, number one, taking credit for it, but number two, much more importantly, sabotaging it.
It could very well.
I mean, that's what it's there for. To prevent that, because it ceases to exist once wholeness comes about.
It's afraid of that. I'm not 100% sure the ego absolutely ceases to exist, even though at the beginning I said one of the things to do is to relax the ego.
Yeah.
But I think that the ego may be the mechanism by which our interface with the physical reality is probably made. But what's happened is that the ego has got itself inflated.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the fact that as long as we're physical, right, if we want to call it a spiritual expression in a physical form or a psychological expression in a physical form, then it's quite likely the ego itself will never really go away. But it'll have a different role. It won't be the center of our universe.
So, I think this brings us back to thing I said about the ego being a movable term. So would you say that as you're talking about it now, the ego is a different ego than what we've been talking about earlier in terms of a constructed identity that is a defense system?
Yes.
It is.
It is a different thing.
Right. So then I would agree, except that I'm not sure if you're right.
I mean,
I agree it's possible, but I'm not sure. I mean, if you want to talk about the mind now, because you've mentioned it a few times, I don't think I use it word hardly at all now, because every time I hear it, I want to say, what is that? What do you mean by mind?
And that's a very good question. I don't have a good answer. I will ponder about that.
Because I know I have thoughts, and there's a thinking, there's a whatever. There's a chain of thoughts constantly running through this organism that I am aware of and that I have identified with for most of my life and that I've referred to as the mind. But if you took away language, then I wouldn't think in the way that I'm used to thinking. Therefore, I'm not sure I would have a mind, as I understand it. So then, is mind just a byproduct of language? That's the question that I constantly
have. It's a chicken and egg conundrum. Chomsky is interesting in his approach to that. Have you read Chomsky in Language at all?
I know that you're a fond of Chomsky because you brought him up, but I've only seen the documentary. I've never read him.
Yeah, his language arguments are quite interesting, and he in a way which surprised me, I came to the awareness that he actually sees the human animal in much the same way that Carl Jung did. And I made this observation quite a while ago, and then, much to my pleasant surprise, Fritz Lieber's son, the science fiction writer Fritz Lieber, he has, I forget his name now, wrote a book. He was a linguist, and he wrote a book on Carl Jung, and he made the observation that there's a similarity between Jung's approach to language acquisition, in a sense, and Carl Jung's unconscious or collective unconscious. What Chomsky argues is that there's something in the human animal, the human being, if you want to call it that, which is a language thing.
Is a language thing?
He calls it the black box.
Yeah. Oh, that's like the black iron prison.
Right.
I once had a psychedelic vision, or not, it wasn't even a vision, it was a visceral, horrific experience of myself as a black box floating in infinite space.
Interesting. Anyway, so Chomsky calls it a black box. And what happens is you take this, the human being, and the example he gives is you take a person born in Japan, right? So an infant born in Japan, and you put them in New York, and that person is a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen? It's not genetic, right? There is something in the human animal, and it's in all humans, which is a language creature.
Mm-hmm.
So is there an ability to separate the human animal, as we understand it at this point, between language / mind?
But how does that... I don't really understand that as an example, because if the constructed identity is built through language, then sure, that person would think they were a New Yorker, but they wouldn't really be a New Yorker. I mean, there is no such thing as a New Yorker.
And that's part of the nice, funny part. But the reality is that person will, at a very basic level, speak, think, and talk as someone who has been raised and born in New York.
Well, sure. But doesn't that just prove that cultural social conditioning can hack into biology and even...
At that level it can, but the more interesting level is why is it that the language is not related to genetics?
As in, why couldn't he just organically speak Japanese?
Right. So, but why not? We organically, as human beings, we grow fingernails.
Right.
Right?
So, but then,
why don't we just grow words?
That seems to prove the opposite to Chomsky's point, that language has to be implanted in us.
He doesn't say that it has to be implanted.
I'm saying that. No. But his point seems to be that we are naturally language makers.
We are naturally language makers. So then the question now becomes your question about mind, is that if we had no language, you know, what is mind? Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing you a little bit there, but that's kind of what you said.
Yeah.
And it may be that it's like saying that, okay, well, if you're dead, are you alive?
Well, no, if you're dead, you're not alive.
That's my point. Yeah. Is that it's quite possible that as a physical manifestation of human energy,
mm-hmm.
is that there is no distinction between mind and language.
So it's chicken or an egg, basically.
Yes.
So, okay, yes, fine. So then we're agreeing that language and mind, to some degree, are synonymous. So there are autistics who think in images. And
yes.
So there are variables here.
But in order for them to communicate in the human world at some point along the way...
They have to learn to mimic language, but not necessarily internalize it.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's one of the questions I wrestle with. Is it necessary to internalize language? And more importantly, is it desirable?
Yeah, and that's a tough question. Mm. And you may even find that Chomsky talks about that a little bit somewhere, but I haven't read enough of his language stuff to know.
Because Castaneda, not to end on a very out there thing, and Castaneda's not a trustworthy ceremony master, but anyway... He talks about language being, and William Burroughs did too, and I think Dick must have done in his way, language being an external element or even entity that invades us and takes over our consciousness, like a parasite. Language is a parasite.
Okay, that could be. Yeah. But I'll go in the Chuang Tzu route, if you don't mind.
What's that?
Chuang Tzu, yeah. Chinese philosopher. And yeah. I like him the best because he's the butterfly guy.
Yeah.
He's known for the butterfly, but yeah. He's got a lot more better stuff than the butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
He says, one of my favorite parables from him has to do with a fishing trap is for catching fish. Once you've caught the fish, you don't need the trap anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A springe is for catching hares. Once you've caught the hare, you don't need the springe anymore.
Until you get hungry again.
Correct.
Yeah.
But words are for capturing ideas.
Yeah.
Once you've caught the idea, you don't need words anymore. So where can I find someone to have a few words but no words?
Was that the end of the quote?
Yes, more or less. I'm paraphrasing a bit. Mm. And so you have the same challenge. So Chuang Tzu is looking at the problem of language as well. And if you read Chuang Tzu and you're curious about language in mind, he talks about that a lot.
Right. I did read him a long time back, my 20s. So I may have even read some of that stuff and internalized it and forgotten about it.
Yeah, revisit him because it's an interesting conundrum. And I do wrestle with this as well, the problem of where language stops in a sense and where non-language is. I mean, it may be that as a human being, it's almost impossible to realize that, except in certain states of meditative trance or drugs or perhaps sleeping in some cases, or if you're a gifted autistic in a certain way, perhaps. I don't know.
It may also be that it's that thing again, that we have this thing that we do for the constructed identity to feel it's being included, but it's also to trick, quote-unquote, the ego to not pay attention to what's really happening.
But I think that's more in a cultural thing than an inherent thing, right? So you look at different cultures in which, let's say, a culture values dreams, right? So their approach to the dream world is going to be completely different. Their indoctrination, their cultural manifestation will be different. How they indoctrinate people, different.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make it good or bad? So the fact that we set up our own personal one in North America, or if you want to call it pan-global these days, the capitalistic idealism having spread pretty much everywhere, Thomas Hobbes' idea of the human animal being spread everywhere, then we again have the chicken and egg problem, is that once we start acting as if this is true, then we will make it true. The universe will respond to ourselves and make it true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a great example of us, the human animal, making things true in a book by Francis Fukuyama called Trust. And the book is about capitalism and the role of trust in the proper functioning of capitalism. It's quite a fascinating book in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the story that stands out to me was a study that was done on the role of altruism, or the role of money on altruism. And what had happened is what they did is they gave students in the university $100, or theoretically gave them $100. If you got $100, you found $100. It was a windfall. And it's your money. You can't be returned, and you've got it. What are you going to do with the money? And so I don't know how exactly they set up the poll, but there's a series of answers. Well, I'm going to buy my girlfriend a nice supper, or I'm going to buy my parents something, or I'm going to pay my bills down, or whatever it happens to be, a whole range of various activities. And when they took a look at the answers, they broke it down by the faculties. And in the economics department, the overwhelming majority did something selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rest of the faculties, it was a whole range of things, mostly unselfish.
Mm-hmm.
So economists are taught that greed is good,
right,
and that greed is natural behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But the people in the other departments aren't taught that. So we manufacture our behavior by teaching beliefs.
Right. So that normalizes it, and then that creates a system in which that behavior is rewarded, and then that reinforces it.
And that applies to how we raise and do everything.
So how does this apply to language?
Language. So if, in fact, we think of language as a construct which is going to allow us to be powerful, right? If you're going to make it in the world, you're going to learn your language and you're going to learn this, then that automatically manifests an ego which is going after power. If, in fact, the ideology of the universe or the school or the society is language is going to allow you to explore the language of dreams, then instantly you've created a different society.
Well, different language, too.
You would have to reshape.
Well, the language would be shaped by the subject it was used to describe.
But the motivation is what starts the change. And it's hard for us to kind of, I think, see this, because it's like a fish trying to see water. Right?
Yeah. It's an analogy I use a lot. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we have the same issue with our language. So we can say that Thomas Hobbes is true, and then we all pretend it's true, and so we make it true.
Leviathan, and specifically, which point about Thomas Hobbes?
Oh, Thomas Hobbes, that the human animal is, life is nasty, dirty, short, and various other things, and I forget. Right. But he's the one who's on the brutal,
brutish.
Use the word brutal, brutish.
Nasty, brutish, and short. Yeah.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
Right. So we can say that, and then we can make it all true.
That's social engineering.
Correct. The challenge with that is that as soon as the society accepts that it's true, and there's an acceptance there, right? We can reject that truth. Is it social engineering or not? It's like the conspiracy theory, right? The conspiracy theory is fine. It's based upon a them and us. But the reality is if the society believes in, for example, deservedness, right, then is it a conspiracy that the people who are the smartest get what they deserve? Or is that just an expression of our beliefs about what a society needs to be?
Sure, conspiracy theory is insufficient. I mean, it's not paranoid enough.
Yes.
Because it's incepted in us from before birth.
Yeah,
the ideological structures that maintain the power structures.
It's another funny thing about what we'll call it social engineering. I'll go back to economics, where I've got some familiarity. Is not too long ago in the 1600s, I guess, the notion of there being currency as an efficient means of running a society was laughed at and scoffed at by the business elite of Britain. No one would accept currency as a means of doing business, he said. Ridiculous.
Right.
Who would handle that?
When was this?
In the 1670s or 1680s. Maybe the early 1700s. The reference is in the book called Debt by David Graeber.
Right.
But now, as a community, we can't imagine a society which doesn't have currency. Even though we're starting to move away from currency, a little bit with debit cards and credit cards and things. But the reality is that people can't even imagine that money at one time didn't really exist. Is that social engineering? Maybe. Is it just an acceptance? Maybe. I'm not sure. It's all related to language, though.
Yeah, I think language is primary. That's a primary tool of control. But nothing is just what it appears to be, and everything is springing from the source.
Yes.
So that was my attempted point about language, is that the way in which it is used to control us can be turned around, not to set us free, but that you and I can have a conversation using language, but part of us knows, and even if we didn't know, this could happen, that what's communicating is not restricted to language.
Correct.
Like we're having a full body communication,
yes,
full psyche to psyche. I'm not to say it's 100%. We're not Buddhas. Buddha and Christ hanging out or anything like that. Nothing, no claims to greatness there, but just in terms of the potential, being aware of the potential. And that the language provides a, not just a pretext, because we wouldn't just sit here and, you know, tune in, and it wouldn't make much of a podcast if we did, but it also is a good distraction. Because the part of us that isn't going to get it and is going to sabotage anything from happening if it sees it is engaged.
Yes.
And it's enjoying itself. So it lets other stuff happen. That's how I'm beginning to experience language and why I don't love it less for recognizing its parasitical qualities.
Yes. Somehow. Well, if this helps at all, what I came to the realization a while ago is that, and it's going to sound funny again, is language is danceable.
Mm.
It dances.
Right.
And so it can be an ugly dance, or it can be a pretty dance, or it can be an energetic dance. But language dances.
Mm.
And so in my writing, I try and encapsulate or bring that kind of dancing energy to it.
Mm.
So, but I don't write very much.
So it's like an internal music that can, like you were talking about your dream earlier, like the psyche has a music of its own, yeah. And that can actually play underneath the language and then even start to come through the language, and then the language gets like magnetic filings with a magnet, it gets reshaped by that underlying melody.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, poetry, of course, aspires to that.
Yes.
Rumi would, I think, be a great example of perhaps a poet that,
yes,
that did a very fine job of expressing the inexpressible. Not that I'm a Rumi fan, but I just thought an example would be helpful.
Yep. Anyway, language is danceable.
Mm.
And so I just consider it to be a dance. And I think this is one of the reasons why I enjoy Chuang Tzu, or maybe now it's these chicken and egg problems, is that having read Chuang Tzu, I saw him dance with language, and so I've now danced with language too. Or I was drawn to Chuang Tzu because I became aware that I loved the dance of language, and he was one of the most danceable readers or writers around.
Right.
I'm not sure which is which there.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
Is there any more to say, or we've got a few more minutes? Or?
There is, of course, more to say, but we're out of time.
And just to keep everything real, we have a lovely three-legged cat.
But yeah, I've been participating.
Sleeping on Jason's lap.
So that's like the third, like, you know, you heard the stories about the third man that, I think Shackleton talked about it, but when people have been known to get lost in the Antarctic or lost in the wild, they become aware at a certain point of this invisible presence,
yes,
that's guiding them.
Yep. I've heard of this.
Mm.
I don't think I've experienced it directly. Have you?
I don't think so. I mean, yes, perhaps, but not in a way that would directly correspond. I think I've had experience of a presence that was watching over, but not in the context of the third man. It's very much of a guiding presence,
yeah,
in times of distress. So I don't think I've had that experience.
Yeah, I haven't had that experience, but my experience is more back to, again, this. Something comes up in my life which is the right thing at the right time. And for many, many years, I would not be aware of that fact, right? Because there was not enough awareness to be aware that, in fact, whatever was happening was the right thing at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
But now I become aware that, oh, okay, I'm open to this. And it's not a person, but it's an energy or an awareness.
Mm-hmm. It may be you.
And it may be me, too, but I wouldn't like to take credit for that. Well,
there's a knock at the door. How's that for metaphysical timing?
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. Is mine. Oh, here comes the monkey. And monkey's face is mine. Oh, here comes the monkey. And monkey's face is mine. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle sec. Ça prépare mon bocou. Ils sont des armes cibles de destruction massive.
When his world came tumbling down, here comes the monkey.